Eyewitness News. In touch, in tune, and independent. For the latest, visit ewn.mobi.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Friday evening. We've got the best bits of The Money Show coming up between 7 and 8. We'll play the Brutal Biz quiz. We'll see why Fitch has given us another pass when it comes to ratings. An astonishing bounce on markets after some really good American jobs numbers. Why those matter and why it's had such a positive impact. A luxury tour of a luxury collection of houses from a luxury portfolio in our Friday files. So lots to come on this evening's edition of The Money Show, which is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, enabling businesses that invest in the future, the bravery to imagine. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Then Japan last year had 10 firearm-related incidents and one firearm-related death. Today, the shock assassination of the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, shot dead at a political rally earlier on this morning. He was Prime Minister twice. Most recently, he resigned for health reasons in 2020, and it made him the longest-serving post-war leader in that country. His assailant, apparently using a homemade firearm, fired two shots. One bullet hit him in the neck, another in the chest. Doctors battled for 5 hours to save him, and eventually he succumbed to his injuries. He did the most of his predecessors to reinvigorate the Japanese economy after two decades of stagnation. They called it Abenomics. It was an approach to try and stimulate growth to get some inflation growing in that economy. And it didn't worked particularly well. The country did go into recession in 2020, and the BBC today saying that it was an exercise as in political branding. That worked incredibly well. Abenomics will go down in the history books. It was a success from a PR point of view, but it did fall short of Abe's own key economic target. So it was disappointing from that perspective, but world leaders today expressing huge shock at the shooting dead at a political rally of the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. It's good to have you with us as we look at a decision by the ratings agency Fitch to leave us on a stable outlook. And we are still very much deep in junk status based on our experience over the last 3 weeks of stage six load shedding. For much of the time, further downgrades would make a lot of sense. And especially if we don't sort this mess out really, really quickly with some sort of sustainable solution in the bag as well. Fortunately for us, the ratings agency Fitch, which like the ratings agencies around it, Moody's and S&P Global, recently upgraded us from negative to stable outlooks. They've decided to maintain the stable outlook. Duncan Peterson is Deputy Director General for Economic Policy at National Treasury. Was it a close-run thing, Duncan?
Good evening, Bruce. Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Was a close-run thing for the ratings agencies, who must have looked at us with a fair amount of circumspection?
Yes, Bruce. Well, as you noted in your opening remarks, I mean, we did get positive outcomes from S&P and Moody's recently. So I think that was helpful. But of course, in Fitch's case, they decided not to change either the rating or the outlook. So I do think, I mean, we've had some positive outcomes from S&P and Moody's, Fitch staying the same. So it is a bit of a mixed bag with the rating agencies at the moment.
But, I mean, we're giving ratings agencies, which have recently given us this more positive outlook, generally speaking, we keep giving them reasons to downgrade us. And I think a lot of people listening to us this evening who have lived through this bout of the worst load shedding in our history, stage six, for nearly 3 weeks now, would be a little bit concerned that, you know, this time we get the pass, but next time we might not be so lucky.
Yeah, well, Bruce, as you know, the rating agencies do take a holistic view at South Africa's public finances and the economy. So, of course, the one aspect that they do look at is growth. And Fitch did note that they are concerned about the constraining impact of power shortages on South Africa's growth outlook, despite the positive quarter one surprise from a GDP perspective. But they did also raise other issues that are positive. And I think that's why, on balance, they decided to keep things where they are. And the, some of the areas that they did raise were, of course, our public finances are slightly better than expected, given what's happening on the revenue side. They do expect our fiscal deficits to stabilize. And they did cite rising inflation, but the fact that South Africa has a very credible monetary policy framework. And then, of course, they raised a host of risks as well, which is why, on balance, they decided to keep things where they are.
Monetary policy framework, of course, is the one element of supreme credibility which South Africa has in its favor. The Reserve Bank has been in very safe hands, you know, since Tito Mboweni's days, and has been remarkably well managed. However, when we look at the fiscal deficit, when we look at all of the things that have started going right for South Africa, we can't sustain those things going right without energy certainty. This must be the thing that is plaguing you at National Treasury more than anything else right now, Duncan.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Bruce, you're right. I mean, the way, of course, energy stability features in the fiscal framework is really in two ways. The one is that it does impact our growth prospects and therefore the kinds of tax revenue we can expect and the investments we can expect private companies to make. And the other way, of course, is that it does present a source of fiscal risk. A major uncertainty because companies are uncertain, therefore they do not invest. And of course, Eskom itself is one of the large state-owned entity risks for the fiscal framework. So from that perspective, it certainly does present a challenge that has had a sort of a negative impact in light of some of the positive developments we've seen recently.
Would you support a call by the National Planning Commission for a state of emergency when it comes to power?
Well, Bruce, I think clearly there's a sense of urgency now to resolve the energy challenge that we haven't seen in recent months or years, and I do think that is positive. I'm not sure how much of a difference a state of emergency itself would make. I do think that there are quite a few actions we can take on an urgent basis, particularly on Eskom's side, in order to resolve the current challenges. And I do sense a renewed urgency to deal with those issues. Of course, some of it can give us relief in the short term, but most of it really will give us relief in the medium term. And to the extent that we can leverage those actions to create the kind of longer-term changes in our electricity market and system that we really need, I think that from that perspective, certainly it can be quite positive.
What sort of measures would you, as National Treasury, support then in terms of a turnaround at Eskom? You're part of the conversation. They're your biggest single liability with debts of over 400 billion rand. And at the rate that they're burning diesel at the moment, that number can only be going up. What sort of moves would you be supportive of?
Well, Bruce, as you'd know, I mean, part of our financial oversight responsibilities over Eskom include the commitment that the minister made this year for us to look at Eskom's debt and look at the manner in which we can deal with that in order for that to no longer be a constraint on Eskom's ability to invest and to undertake the right kind of maintenance. Of course, if you are going to deal with Eskom's debt, you have to deal with it in a manner that A, doesn't create a moral hazard, and B, does not lead to the entity having to come back to the fiscus in the future. So it has to be accompanied by the right kind of conditions so that you have a sustainable entity going forward. And then, of course, we are liaising with Eskom regularly around some of the very specific plant performance and other related issues that can potentially unlock some energy capacity in the very, very short term. Because as you said earlier, without electricity and without a forward-looking path that shows us how we're going to get to a stable electricity situation, it is very difficult for companies to invest. And it does have a very negative economic impact, which then finds its way back into the fiscal framework.
Dr. Duncan Peterson, thanks for the chat as always. Deputy Director General for Economic Policy at the National Treasury. And the thing that strikes me, and I've been fortunate to travel a little bit for the first time in years over the last 2 months, once to the United Kingdom and once to Switzerland to go to the World Economic Forum. And what strikes you as you leave the country is the amount of stuff you don't hear about when you're traveling. You don't hear about massive murder rates. You don't hear about 19 kids dying in a pub. You don't hear about electricity shortages. You don't live with a constant sense of trepidation and abhorrence of the environment in which you live. And that much is very clear. And as we go to this first anniversary, of course, of those dreadful riots in KZN and in Gauteng last year, that's where they were concentrated. And this absolute abject terror that we get a replay. And as we just sit and waiting to see what happens next, just and in an environment after 3 weeks of stage six load shedding, it's no wonder people are fed up. It's absolutely no wonder. But yeah, it was good today. Fitch, the ratings agency, gave us a pass again. And they're not going to be patient forever. It can't just be a plan. There've got to be solutions to this mess.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Amongst our favourite activities as a country is to go on strike, and also to go on strike with violent consequences and with destructive consequences as well, as we've seen through the recent Eskom strike. And a strike now by truck drivers in Mpumalanga is going to hurt chrome exporters. It's hurting the coal industry. We've seen blockaded roads. We've seen transport routes associated with this Mpumalanga shutdown really beginning to hurt commodity exporters. And it's taken a severe toll since Wednesday, taxi and truck drivers blockading critical transport routes. And there's absolutely zero compunction, of course, for the consequences. We've got chrome producers of the Bushveld complex feeling it, Samancor feeling it. And you can't run a business when you're being held ransom to this extent. Barbara Moman is the trade and transport corridor consultant at Coalescence, to do with the word coal there, no doubt. Just paint a picture for me, if you would, Barbara, in terms of what is happening on the ground on this Friday evening.
Thankfully, Bruce, and thank you for having me. It seems to be fairly open and we are almost back to normal, but the past 2 days have been very, very damaging for our economy. I just want to correct the perception that it's a strike by truck drivers. These drivers were forced mostly by taxi drivers to block the road and were unable to move. Some of them are threatened at gunpoint. So,
well, what evidence, Barbara, I mean, I'm sure you're absolutely right, but what evidence do we have that this is a forced strike or a forced action by truck drivers? Far more effective to block a highway with a big truck than 10 taxis, I suppose. But what evidence do we have that this was forced?
Well, we've had reports in that drivers have been held at gunpoint and by taxi operators, and also that certain of the trucking companies have been targeted. We've had a vehicle burnt on the Crocodile River Bridge just near Matsulu on the N4. So it does seem particularly targeted at stopping the supply chain from moving, and that's a major concern.
And what sort of assistance has there been from security services in that sort of region? What sort of help has there been in terms of keeping tempers cool and reopening routes?
Well, I wish I could say that it has been significant and consistent, but you know, I think it seems to have taken even the police by surprise. So we've had some work done by police to prevent any further sort of deterioration. But until sort of late yesterday, police activity was intermittent at certain points. And unfortunately, the entire corridor was held ransom literally from Witbank right through to the Lubombo border post on Wednesday.
So what's caused the routes to reopen? I mean, is it because it's weekend, everybody wants to go home, and we meet again on Monday? What's going on?
Oh, please, I hope there is no repetition on Monday, because this is, you know, this raises the huge issue of how important our international supply chains are, and we really need those to be secure. You know, we're dealing here with markets that are very competitive. And, you know, if we allow this kind of action to be targeted at supply chains that are actually contributing enormously to the economy, then I feel very strongly that it's misdirected and should really be targeted directly at government engagement and not, you know, shooting ourselves in the foot, which it seems to be, because the losses, just to, as you mentioned in the introduction, to the mining companies are significant, and those can never be recouped because you can't make up lost time in terms of those tonnages, those daily tonnages that have not been able to move. So when you're looking at a 50 million rand loss for 2 days for chrome, for example, that is not chicken feed. It's
absolutely.
Really,
so, I mean, this is blocking coal access down to Richards Bay, to the coal terminal there. Where does the chrome go out of? Does that go out of Maputo or where from?
No, look, we're talking about the Maputo corridor. So there's significant coal moving on the Maputo corridor to the port of Maputo. This is transit cargo destined for most often India and the Far East. And chrome is on the same page as far as the movement, the international market movement is concerned. So it is very, very important that an understanding is created that while drivers are driving these vehicles, that they're very much part of an international supply chain. The markets are competitive. We can't actually afford at this stage in our economy's history to be tossing this out of the window. And really what we need is a greater sense of security that our companies can, and transport operators can actually do their jobs, and that mines can actually export their cargo. The challenge has been with the lack of sufficient rail capacity, the loss of Richards Bay's capacity, and a huge extent in Durban as well. So we're looking at a real crisis in terms of getting cargo to the markets, and that's why this has been such a real, well, I'd say it's a tragedy for supply chain security.
Barbara, thank you very much. Barbara Moman, who is the Trade and Transport Corridor Consultant at Coalescence.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
An astonishing day on markets today. It really was. I mean, yesterday was good. Today was turning into a fairly meh day. But there are a couple of things that are not adding up, Viv Govender. Viv Govender is a portfolio manager at Rand Swiss. Those things that aren't adding up is we are in a higher inflation phase for the world economy, and we're seeing very high inflation rates. For some people, they've never seen inflation in developed economies this high. That's leading to higher and rising interest rates. We're then seeing fears of a recession. Then we see today American companies adding jobs at a higher than expected rate. And that is a contradiction to everything that we're seeing happen in the world at the moment. Can you please explain it in words of one syllable or less?
I remember when I first started on the markets, one of the older traders told me, percentage I remember today, he says, the most profitable sentence in the English language is, the US Fed is trying to do something and it's not working. Because whenever the Fed tries to do something, it will eventually work because they have unlimited firepower. What the U.S. Fed is trying to do right now is slow down the U.S. economy in order to fight inflation. That's doing it by raising interest rates. That is eventually going to start working. Right now, we do have, yes, you know, more job openings than workers at the moment in the U.S. It's almost 2-to-1, but that ratio is coming down. We are seeing, things like, for instance, mortgage rates rise. We are seeing the cost of fuel and cost of food rising. And eventually that's going to feed down to workers basically looking for jobs. Because, yes, there is a low unemployment rate. But remember, the labor force participation rate for the U.S. is almost double digits below its all-time high. So there's a significant amount of people that are not in the labor force at the moment. That's one of the reasons we're seeing this low unemployment rate. But I think as the U.S. Fed keeps on this rate hiking cycle, which it should if the forecast for next week's CPI number comes in as expected, given the like rather good employment number we saw right now, that eventually is going to result in unemployment increasing.
Okay, so what we've got is perhaps it's an anomaly right now, but the trends remain very much firmly in place. Inflation is high, rates will continue to rise, and eventually that effect will be felt in the economy, and we'll start to see that economy slow down a bit, and that will lead to things making a little bit more sense. It does raise the risk, though, that the Fed is going to be aggressive and continue to be aggressive, and maybe that is why we saw just such a sharp sell-off today in the rand against every major international currency, sharply weaker against the euro, sharply weaker against the pound, and particularly as we've been seeing a destruction of the rand's value against the dollar this week.
Oh yeah, mostly. Look, I mean, the dollar rand, number is very, very different in certain ways. If, for instance, the dollar euro, the rand euro number. So in rand terms, we are the weakest we've been in more than a year. In euro terms, that's not true. We are the weakest we've been since about, March. We're not talking about that far back here. This is not the kind of environment where you are seeing the rand basically at levels that I haven't seen for more than a year. And that's to do with the fact that the dollar has been so strong. And the dollar is so strong because the Fed is aggressive, raising rates, meaning that you're going to get less yield elsewhere, and then you want to get to the dollar. But I think eventually the euro and the pound, the Bank of England, are going to have to follow the dollar's path. So their inflation rates are not, much better than the US.
And for now, the ratings agencies give us a pass, but they're not going to keep on that forever. I was talking to Duncan Peterson at National Treasury earlier, and he's putting on the brave face of, the data's good and everything's fine and we'll be fine as long as we get electricity. But the electricity crisis that we've seen materialize and deepen over the last 3 weeks is something that could, end the South African Recovery Party very, very quickly if we don't get a firm handle on it.
Oh yeah, most certainly. But I think the two key problems in Africa at the moment are the education problem, which is a long-term problem, and the electricity problem, which is a short to medium-term problem. And both of those things are the real constraints on our growth rate. Nothing else really matters. And we can't basically have electricity provided at a constant rate with a significant buffer between normal usage and what the utility can provide. We literally can't grow, because if we did grow, the market electricity would rise, and potentially load shedding would stop growth. So yeah, this is a serious bottleneck for the country. Regarding our outlook, yes, we've already revised to positive from negative, but we remain in junk status. I mean, there is, according to rates agencies, a significant chance of us defaulting, which is what junk status kind of means. So it is an outlook improvement, but not a reality improvement at the moment.
Thank you, Viv Govender, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss this evening. It was a strange day on the market. I mean, as that US jobs number came out, there was almost the sigh of relief to say, hold on a second. Yes, the world economy is slowing, and yes, things were, we headed perhaps to a softer landing than we may have feared previously. Rather than a sudden stop, we may get a soft landing on global markets, and that would be very, very welcome. And suddenly we saw markets, which in Europe and the United Kingdom had been quite soggy throughout the day, end in positive territory. US markets moved into the black, and the JSE, which was in and out of positive territory for much of the day, ended 418 points stronger, a hefty 0.2% higher for second day in a row. Really nice and strong. And the all-share index finishing this week on a far better note than you would have anticipated, on 68,327. Viv Govender, Rand Swiss, thank you.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, enabling businesses that invest in the future. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Friday evening. The Brutal Biz Quiz coming up in about 10 minutes. Fabulous questions just to test whether or not you've been paying attention this week. A couple of lovely little facts and figures coming out. We've got the best bits of The Money Show between 7 and 8. But first, let me tell you what's happening on your next Money Show. Bronwyn Williams, the trend translator, the future finance specialist at Flux Trends, is going to be reviewing her most recent read. And I think she consumes about 5 or 6 books a week. She's vociferous in her reading habits. Our business book feature on the next Money Show. Plus, of course, our favorite feature of the week for many of you, which is Other People's Money. Plus all the other big money stories of the day as we tee up the next week on the Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
And I've had a dreadful Friday. An absolutely awful Friday. I've been dreaming about things I can't afford. Holiday houses. Now, holiday houses are a wonderful thing. They're the preserve of the wealthy. People who can afford to have a second or third or sometimes more home somewhere that they love to go regularly, they're also happy to leave it locked up for most of the year. Some, though, fortunately for the rest of us, are willing to share. And that way you get to go to cool places which you might not otherwise have been afforded to buy. And you get a nice big treat. You might go for a weekend or a week even and pay lots of money in the short term to get an enormous benefit at somebody else's expense, with the big advantage, of course, that you've got no ties to one single place and you can go to a different place each and every single year, not have to worry about rates and taxes, security, leaky roofs, anything like that. Airbnb certainly does very well out of that trade, but if you're looking for something extra special, I want to introduce you to the co-founder of the Art House Collection, and that is Ilana Brandain, who's on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. How many properties have you got in total in the Art House Collection, Ilana?
Hi, we've now, at this point, since we've launched in November, we're about on 35 properties, but it's growing all the time because we, of course, find incredible gems. So it keeps on growing.
What are the requirements to be accepted into the network? Because I was surfing this afternoon and getting very depressed about just the magnificence. I mean, I shouldn't have been depressed. I should be excited and inspired. But just depressed that I won't be able to go to every single one of them for a week at a time. Because there are some magnificent properties within your network. What are your requirements to get in there?
I mean, we, as the two partners, you know, we bring our collective way of thinking, and we look for homes that have got a discerning way of how the owner has curated it. And it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be, you know, a big art collection or any of those elements. It's just that somebody has taken real care with knowledge in the way that they've put, you know, from the interior to the way they've designed. The simple things, you know, the way that the care of the house or the way they put together a small collection of art, the way they've looked at, we've got a house, got an incredible collection of succulents. It's just, we choose them, we pick them. So it's the way we look at it. We feel it has to stay quite discerning. We see our client base is looking for those kind of really, like, really gems.
Is this just an excuse for you and your business partner, Ilana, to go to nice places and to say, yes, we're coming to see and we'll consider you? And then you sit and judge and you have a fabulous time, and then you either decide to include or exclude them. Was that the motivation for you to have to go and see some of the country in Namibia and Botswana's best properties?
It is a perk because I see the most beautiful places, but I've been lucky through my art career. You know, I've been part of the art world for the last 30 years, and so I've seen so many beautiful properties, and I'm talking about, you know, a young artist who's got an incredible little apartment, and they even give us a smaller apartment, or a magazine editor who's got an incredible space, and just the way they put something together, you know, the way they collect, the way that they find beautiful things to put in their homes. So, of course, it is a perk to go and see all these homes, and I'm actually blown away with the quality we have in South Africa. I mean, honestly, everywhere you go, people have got incredible style. So it's not difficult to find beautiful properties in our country.
I mean, yeah, and you talk about your art career. I mean, you've done many, many things over decades, but you were instrumental in the launching of the Zeitz Mocha, in those, of course, at the V&A Waterfront. You were a previous CEO of the Norval Foundation. And that, of course, creates a huge network, and it creates a huge amount of access as well, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I think the art world is, you know, it's proven, and they say it's access and not excess these days, which is the real luxury. And the art will give you incredible access, you know, on different tiers and different levels. So, you know, from a young student where you would go and visit them in their studio and they sleep in their studio. But, you know, when people are, like, for me, the interesting thing is when they're passionate about something and they're interested and they have deep knowledge and they put things, you know, they spaces that they live in is beautiful. So that's the things that I've witnessed through many years. And now, luckily, I'm bringing the two passions together, which is, of course, travel and being also the art world. And we've seen these beautiful homes, beautiful collections that we see in Cape Town, in all over the country. So it's been wonderful. You know, at least I know where all the beautiful places are, you know.
Exactly. I mean, you've got some well-known places on your list. Elliman House, Paul Harris, former one of the first RAND co-founders, Elliman House in Cape Town on the Atlantic seaboard, has got an astonishing art collection. I mean, in addition to it being, of course, an iconic property, it's one of those places where the finest art that is available in South Africa is on public display. And it becomes then the experience of the getaway, not just the getaway itself.
Yes, I think it's one of the best representative kind of collections that we have in the country. So, you know, any visitor who comes here and stays there have an immediate, like, glimpse into our world, you know, not only the historical, but they also see, you know, what's going on contemporary. They've got the beautiful contemporary gallery at the bottom. So it really is a very beautiful way of understanding a culture very quickly, because you are really deeply embedded in it when you see all of the work and what it's all about.
And in terms of the regionality of the properties, you've got two properties, as far as I could tell, in Botswana, one in Okavango Delta. It's an astonishing property, 24 beds, less than $3,000 a night, which is a lot of money. But for that much accommodation and to have that level of exclusivity and privacy in a place like the Delta is nothing short of extraordinary. How are you coming to a price point for these properties, which by South African standards may be pricey, but by global standards are immensely affordable?
You know, it is very difficult because, you know, supply and demand is probably one of the ways what one look at it. But COVID has been also instrumental in, you know, throwing everything out of the window. But it's a process of, you know, talking it through, seeing what is out there, seeing the connoisseurship of the property. So we go through a whole list of just making sure that it is still, in a way, the value for money of what you experience is kind of related to that price. You know, we're talking about our properties on the continent, but we're also looking at actually extending it over the East Africa, West Africa, you know, so we can actually become known as a place where you, if you want to find those special properties, you come to Art House Collection.
I mean, 20, 30 years ago, it was the portfolio of country places. But this is portfolio of country places on steroids. With your best art curator's eye and descriptive skills, because I'm sure that you've had to describe complex artworks to people over many, many years, I would like you, please, to give me an audio description of the most astonishing property in your portfolio, from my perspective anyway, The Nest at Sosie's Vlei, which is inspired by the weaver's nests that happen in the trees in Sosie's Vlei. And it's the most astonishing, astonishing thatch property I think I've ever seen.
I mean, honestly, the depth of the knowledge of what they've gone through, you know, to look at small detail. And I suppose that's the thing, because we see incredible design everywhere. You see incredible architecture. You know, humanity has shown so many geniuses. But honestly, when it comes to fine detail, so it's not only, it's also in the human touch, which you experience in those properties, the way that they welcome you, the way that they... So honestly, there is so much we can tell you and show you, that in one sentence it's very difficult to do it.
No, absolutely, but it's like going and living inside a beautifully crafted bird's nest, and then the artworks outside are made, but looks like out of local stone, possibly some discarded brickwork and local clay, and you've got these magnificent sculptures that are embedded into the landscape, these human head figures that are probably the size, what, about 6-8 foot tall? I mean, vast artworks, which are then set in this very desolate and achingly beautiful landscape that is Sosie's Vlei.
Yeah, it is absolutely beautiful. Have you ever been?
I haven't. I know people who have. I know lots of very, very well-traveled people. I'm looking at on your website, and I feel like I have been, and I even have hay fever and allergies from that beautiful thatch work that is done there. But you've crafted a most extraordinary collection, Ilana, and it really is in itself a work of art, all of these properties put together in a portfolio, and I look forward to seeing how it expands. The co-founder of the Art House Collection. Sorry, I keep interrupting you, Ilana, but final thought?
No, thank you so much. I love your fact that you actually saw the amount of care taken to find these properties. Thank you.
No, it's an extraordinary job, but it's a curation of properties. It's not just sort of clapping together and mooting them together in a mixture and saying, okay, now that's pretty, that's nice. Just put them all together on a website. Let's hope somebody books. It's crafted. It is a work of art. So that's what the Friday File is all about. Ilana Brandane, who is instrumental in the creation of the Zeitz Mocha, which is an astonishing gallery, if you've not seen it, in the waterfront in Cape Town, carved into these grain silos, concrete grain silos that were an absolute eyesore, and they've created the most astonishing precinct there. And then the Norval Foundation, which is next to the Stellenberg Golf Course in Cape Town as well, an astonishing collection of artworks there too. And Ilana Brandane bringing those to life with a portfolio of really top-level accommodation at prices which may make your eyes water, but it's the sort of stuff that the vast majority of us will never, ever, 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 ever contemplate being able to afford to buy, but you can have it for a period of time, a weekend, a week if you're incredibly lucky. And if you've got well-placed friends, you invite them around and you split the cost. Let's get somebody else. There's always that one person in the restaurant who says, "Now I'll do the bill. And you wonder why they always do the bill. And then you figure out, hold on a second, but there were 12 of us and it's only been split 11 ways. That person, be careful. Don't let them be in charge of splitting this accommodation bill because that'll upset you. Coming up in a moment, the brutal biz quiz. Let's do that. First question, Mpumi Madisa is the chief executive of which JSE-listed company? Been around for 35 years or so. It has got a tiny head office, an art collection of a single painting. When I met the founder in that office, I don't know if they've doubled the art collection perhaps. But Mpumi Madisa is the chief executive of which JSE-listed company? She made an acquisition in Australia this week. What is the name of the company of which Mpumi Madisa is chief executive? On 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Give us a call. Let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz this Friday night.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, enabling businesses that invest in the future. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Bok, 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 bok. Are you chicken? Why are you not playing? 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Come and play the biz quiz. Mpumi Madisa is chief executive of a listed company. It was started by a single founder who ran it for about 30 years. Then one of his executives took over, and Mpumi, who joined the company about 12 years ago, risen through the ranks, became the CEO just before COVID. It's a company that, amongst other things, and here's an interesting list. I mean, they're best known for managing the washrooms and moving bags around airports and doing those sorts of things. But if you still write letters on a pad, you may use Croxley stationery. You may boil your water in a Russell Hobbs kettle or a Sultan kettle or a Pineware kettle. You may go on holiday and take your luggage may be Cellini. Or if you have a headache, you may take a Panado or a Compral headache tablet, which is made by the medicines company in which Midvest... this company has got a big stake. You may use Epimax cream if you have a baby with a bum rash. And if you can't stay awake, you may take BioPlus. Godfrey in Midrand. Mpumi Madisa is chief executive of which company?
Midvest
is absolutely right. In addition to all of those things and many, 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 many more, they bought a business in Australia called BIC Services. It's a company that does cleaning at 3,250 sites across Australia. It looks like a good fit for Bidvest. Who in politics is also known as Bojo?
Come again?
who in politics is also known as Bojo?
Is this South African politics?
It's not South African politics. There are lots of people who people think of Bojo in South African politics, but this is...
You're talking about Boris Johnson.
No. Boris Johnson, absolutely right. Boris Johnson. He is the Prime Minister, soon to be former Prime Minister, stepped down as leader of the Conservative Party and desperately holding on to his job. In the world of mergers and acquisitions, MSC, which is a shipping company, is teaming up with Remgro to buy which South African business?
I know Rupert is involved with those guys.
He is.
Remco is. But I'm going to kick myself because...
You are going to kick yourself, Godfrey.
I'm
going to
kick myself because he does on this program again. God.
I'm the winner. Godfrey, it's Mediclinic. I'll put you out of your misery. I'll give you the hospital pass. Godfrey and Midrand, I am the whiz of the biz quiz this evening. Mediclinic, country's largest hospital operator, an MSC shipping company. It's teaming up with Remgro to buy Mediclinic. Coming up next, after Eyewitness News, of course, is the best bits of the Money Show from the week that has been. And you can hear some of the interviews we've done around some of those stories that we've been talking about in the biz quiz this evening. Thank you for playing, Godfrey, and everybody else who finally did call in. But I am the winner of tonight's Political Biz Quiz. Points for me.